I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Martha Stewart, who built an empire based on home decor and the culinary arts, is going to jail. A federal judge sentenced Stewart to 5 months in a minimum security prison and 5 months under home confinement for lying about a stock sale. Stewart emerged from the courthouse in New York City this morning and made an overture to her many fans.
Our magazines are great. They deserve your support. And whatever happened to me personally shouldn't have any effect whatsoever on the great company Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia. And I don't want to use this as a sales pitch for my company, but we love that company.
Joining us on the line from New York is Diane Brady, editor of Business Week. And Diane, Stewart said other things as well, but as we just heard, she made almost a sales pitch for her company, staring defiantly into the camera. What do you make of this?
Well, I think in some ways she feels she's been vindicated. I mean, first of all, she's not being hauled directly off to jail. She did get 10 months, but 5 months of that is under house arrest, which, you know, in the case of Martha Stewart, is not going to be a bad life. And they're appealing, and they obviously think they have strong grounds for appeal. So I think that she's had a lot of fans writing to her. She really feels like she's been wronged, and she probably feels that she's on the road to recovery at this point.
And we understand that right after the announcement, the stock in her company shot up.
It did. Now, some of that may be euphoria. This is a very thinly traded stock, and it's also one that's not held by a lot of institutions. So you've seen very rapid movements. We saw the same thing. We saw a surge, in fact, before her actual verdict was announced on the conviction. So I don't think that the long-term fortunes of the company have improved that much in the space of, you know, an hour or two. But clearly people are excited. This is on the lighter end of what people were expecting for Martha.
Right, because what could have happened?
She could have gone to prison for 16 months, which was what some people thought would happen. Certainly a lot of people thought she'd be in prison for a year. And they thought that she'd have to serve her time while she was appealing. So in many ways, it looks like she, at the very least, she'll be able to avoid jail time for a while longer, and the most she's going to spend is 5 months, which in the grand scheme of things is not that much.
And some would say the prison that she's going to is about a half hour from her home. It's in Danbury, Connecticut, and considered kind of a white-collar prison.
Well, and I think that's probably appropriate. What we have here is a first-time offender, and there's still a lot of people out there who feel that this case should never have even come to court. She was convicted of lying about something that was never deemed to be a crime. So she's not the type of person you would send off to Sing Sing. But you're right. It's definitely not hardship. It's not ball and chain. And she probably is not going to have too bad a life during that five-month stint.
Now, later this afternoon, Peter Bakanovic is expected to be sentenced as well. He was also convicted of lying in this 2001 stock sale. Does Martha Stewart's sentencing shed any light on his?
I think it does insofar as he's in the same boat. He's a first-time offender. He was not actually directly involved in terms of the conversation with Martha. And he lobbied hard to get separated from Martha in terms of the sentencing because he feels that her celebrity has been impeding his case.
And just briefly, Diane, I don't mean to be flip about this, but has Martha Stewart said anything about work she might do from jail?
You know, let's face it, if you talk about somebody who has skills to lend to the general populace, she's one of the better candidates you could find. I think that her lawyers have very much lobbied for her to be working, for example, with venture funds to help women start up businesses. I do not doubt that when she's in prison, she will be trying to be a model prisoner and will also be trying to use her skills. Now, whether she redecorates the place, she may not have the liberty to do that. But I don't doubt that her business skills and her other skills, she'll try to put those to use.
Diane, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Diane Brady, editor at Business Week in New York. After years of trying, the Food and Drug Administration may finally be able to regulate the tobacco industry. Observers say that a Senate bill passed last night has a strong chance of becoming the first law that would allow FDA regulation of the smoking industry. The bill also sets up a smoker-funded buyout of tobacco growers. And for that reason, it has the support of several key senators from tobacco states. The legislation was bitterly opposed by most cigarette companies, but at least one of them, the giant Philip Morris Company, supported it. And to go forward, the bill must still be reconciled with a House bill passed earlier this year. So, as always, the nexus of tobacco and Washington politics is complicated. For some clarity, we're joined by Anna Mollison. He's congressional correspondent for the Cox Newspaper Bureau in Washington. Hi, Andy.
Hello. How are you, Ryan?
I'm fine. Let's start with the FDA. It's tried for years to regulate the tobacco industry. It's been rebuffed by the courts and Congress. Under this new regulation, what would the FDA be able to do?
The short way to put it is it would be able to regulate the sale, the manufacture, and the advertising of tobacco products.
It could mandate that advertisements only be in black and white. It could require producers to put stronger health warnings on the labels.
It could also even go so far as to specify how things would be advertised in a convenience store.
Well, now let's talk about this buyout program that was the incentive for many to get on board the bill. It's for tobacco growers. Now, we know that farmers grow tobacco under a 70-year-old quota system. It guarantees them a market. This bill sets up a $12 billion program, and what is that going to do?
That's going to gradually phase out that system of helping tobacco growers, because many of them are getting out of the business now that we have so much cheaper tobacco coming in from abroad, plus a lessening demand due to the fact that fewer Americans are smoking than used to smoke.
So if this is going to buy out those farmers, why are there some critics of the buyout?
Originally, quota holders and farmers were the same group back in the Depression of the 1930s. Many people today who grow tobacco lease their quotas from somebody who has inherited it or who purchased it from another holder.
So some of the money will go to people who aren't even farmers. They just own the quota.
That's right. The reason the growers opposed this thing for so long was they were afraid they're going to have an FDA guy sitting on their tractor telling them how to farm because their soil has trace arsenic in it or something like that, see?
And so if
they they're afraid that indirectly, even though it's the makers who are being regulated, they're afraid that eventually that would filter down to them.
The farmers.
Yeah, but they are hurting so much, and they want this buyout so much that they've completely reversed their position since the year 2000, when almost all growers were against the buyout. Mm. Now they've switched. They'll take anything. They don't care who regulates the makers. Give us the money.
Yeah. Well, most tobacco companies were opposed to this legislation. Why was Philip Morris Company in favor of it?
We don't know. We know what Philip Morris says, which is that the combination of the regulation and the buyout, on balance, struck them as a fair compromise. But there is a worry on the part of some small tobacco companies that because Philip Morris is the largest company, if advertising is restricted, people will order up only well-known brands. Mm. And Philip Morris has well-known brands.
And finally, the FDA is supposed to, you know, look out for the health of Americans. Can they outright ban cigarettes?
The law specifically says they cannot ban cigarettes, but it also gives them power to review the ingredients of cigarettes. I would say that the most important part of this bill is the part that would require every cigarette manufacturer within 6 months of it becoming law to send in to the FDA all the ingredients in every one of its cigarettes. The FDA may then look at some of those ingredients and say you have to get them out.
Well, Andy Mollison, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Andy is congressional correspondent for the Cox Newspaper Bureau. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
The Presbyterian Church has voted to begin a process that could result in selective divestment from companies that do business with Israel. That resolution came this month at the church's annual General Assembly. With nearly 3 million U.S. members and combined pension fund and foundation assets estimated at $7 billion, the Presbyterians are the first major Christian denomination to call for such a move. The Reverend Victor McCary is the Presbyterian liaison to the Middle East. He joins us from his office in Louisville. And Reverend McCary, why has the church called for this process to begin, and why now?
The church for many years have been outspoken about the conflict in Israel and Palestine, each time specifically calling for Israel's right to exist within legitimate and secure borders. That is a given and a position from which we have never moved. And at the same time, calling for justice for the Palestinian people. at this year's assembly, this proposal came from one of our congregations in Florida, overturing the assembly to take action to send a message that we care very much that the conflict end and end in a peace and just resolution.
And can you be specific as to what divestment would mean if it were to be approved?
What this would mean would be that we will look into companies whose business in Israel might be directly or sometimes indirectly causing some harm to Israeli or Palestinian civilians.
Well, Jewish leaders are describing this as very troublesome, one-sided, heavy-handed, a catastrophic disaster. Unlike apartheid, which had few defenders, there are many people who think that a word and a tool as powerful as divestment should be used sparingly, if at all.
We have resisted for many, many years proposals to call for sanctions or blanket disinvestment, and it seems that the time has come because no peace process has produced a desirable result so far, and it appears necessary that we speak up a little more clearly about how much we care about justice for Israelis and Palestinians.
So you don't think it's one-sided?
We have never been one-sided in our actions.
Well, Reverend Makaria, as I'm sure you know, the Roman Catholic Church just last week for the first time signed a declaration equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. What about those who say, we think this is anti-Semitic?
We have clear statements about our position vis-a-vis the people of Israel, and we have specific statements against anti-Semitism. We may be accused of that, but that doesn't make it so.
Now, you also call for the United States to play a role as an honest broker in the peace process between Israelis and Palestinians. Why do you think that has not been happening?
We have specifically called for that to take place now more than ever before. The U.S. has attempted to be a broker in the peace process, but it consistently has shown a clear bias supporting the actions of the government of Israel. The United States government has often vetoed resolutions of the United Nations, has supported the present regime in Israel as a regime of peace, and there has not been very clear evidence of that being true.
And how long a process will this be?
Well, Presbyterians do things very deliberately, so this could be a very long process.
Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
The Reverend Victor Makary is the Presbyterian Church's liaison to the Middle East. He spoke to us from his office in Louisville, Kentucky.
Just ahead, inside rebel-held Sudan, the region the government in Khartoum might not want the outside world to see.
And later in the program, we'll look at the presidential campaign. Both sides are trying to bring a human touch to it by showcasing their families.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
After a steady stream of horrifying stories from survivors, the situation in Darfur in western Sudan is beginning to get more and more of the world's attention as evidence mounts of Sudanese soldiers and Arab tribesmen armed by the government murdering hundreds of thousands of mostly black Africans. Secretary of State Colin Powell and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan have been in the area recently, but only in areas controlled by the Sudanese government. John Prendergast, an advisor to the International Crisis Group, has just returned from rebel-held territory, an area he says the government in Sudan does not want the world to see. He joins us from Washington. John, welcome.
Thank you.
What did you see, and what were you prepared to see?
Well, we were prepared, of course, to see the one village after another that has been burned to the ground in this year-and-a-half-long ethnic cleansing campaign by the government of Sudan and its allied militias. We didn't expect to meet so many civilians. We had thought that most of the people had left and either run to the refugee camps or gone to these internally displaced camps, which are in government-controlled territory. But it turns out there are perhaps hundreds of thousands of people living in the hills and the small mountains that are outside of the villages that that we went to see, hiding from the possibility of future attack, and spending down the meager resources that they have to the point where many of these people are on are on the brink of starvation. And I think we were also unprepared to witness the aftermath of what one can only conclude was some kind of a planned execution of non-Arab young men, which we had heard rumors about that the government and, and its militias had undertaken, but no one had yet seen visual evidence, which we did. So I think there were a number of new things that were discovered, and it just indicates that we just saw the tip of the iceberg, that the iceberg is a lot bigger than people thought, that the mortality rates, the death rates may even be bigger than we realize at this juncture, and that the worst is yet to come.
What evidence did you find of executions?
Well, we're taken outside of one particular village cluster. Took a Land Rover's a number of kilometers outside of the village in the middle of the desert, and then climbed up a hill and down into a ravine, and then went around a bend. When we came around the bend, there were two long ditches full of bodies of these, as I said, young men who had been executed there. It was clear from the blood flow and other things, and the preservation from the desert heat, that these people had been there, had been executed there. So we don't know who they are, and of course that needs to be the evidence needs to be exhumed. There have to be investigations properly, but certainly it was indicative of something much larger than what we had expected. And the rebels who took us to this location said, there are many other places. Do you want to go? They were physically just too difficult for us to go to some of these places in the limited time we had. So I think that what is urgent is that there needs to be, as we try to grapple with the concept of whether or not this is in fact a genocide, that these kinds of evidences need to be explored and investigated fully and properly.
And did you also find evidence of the water supply being poisoned?
Yeah, this is of course one of the longtime tactics of scorched earth counterinsurgency policy anywhere, and it's sort of scorched earth 101 is when you kill people, you stuff them in the water wells. We had interviewed refugees, and so did many other people in Chad, who had described these horrific scenes of the militias rolling into their villages, burning all of the huts and the houses, and then shooting a number of people and then collecting the bodies and putting them in water wells, which then, of course, poisons the water supply so that people will never return to those villages, creating ghost towns. And then later on, the perpetrator of the crimes can come back and inhabit those places because they mostly want it just for the pasture land. And so we went to some of these places, these locations where the wells were said to be, and we found them covered in sand. So clearly, when the government left and its militias left, they covered their tracks.
So far, John, politicians have been reluctant to call this a genocide, and it's certainly a very powerful word. Is that what you would call it?
I would call it that, and I think an increasing chorus of voices, at least in the United States, are calling it that. The Congress, both the House and the Senate, have introduced resolutions that would call it genocide. It's been a spectacular run. I mean, I think 2 days ago the thing was introduced in the Senate. There's already dozens of senators that have co-signed. Same in the House. I think we're up to over 100 now in the space of a week. And Senator Kerry yesterday at the NAACP convention called it a genocide and called on the Bush administration to act more robustly in consonance with such a designation. So I think that that as the evidence mounts, both in terms of what went on the ground and the intent of those that perpetrated it, I think that the conclusion will be inescapable. But it doesn't change the need, the imperative, as Secretary Powell said, to do something now, regardless of what you call it. But I do think calling it genocide matters because there are implications in the Genocide Convention for what then to do.
Exactly. I was going to say, because of the very power of the word, that's obviously a helpful sign to be able to describe it accurately. But now what? You know, what else needs to happen to really change the situation there?
Well, I think there's three things. First, there has to be an international force deployed. I don't think it should be threatened. I think it has to be deployed now. Civilian protection is an absolute priority, and the troops have to go in and protect civilians in the internally displaced camps, and then when they want to go home down the road. That would be done principally by African troops who are starting to offer themselves to go, We just need to pay for it and need to get those people deployed rapidly. Secondly, we need a lot more money and logistics to be applied to the relief effort. Right now, we're only reaching, the international community is only reaching about 30% of the population in need. So there needs to be a lot more assistance deployed inside Sudan to get the food and medicine and all the other supplies to the people who need it. And then finally, I think there has to be accountability at this point. You know, we've been negotiating with this regime for 15 years and nothing's ever been implemented. These guys have committed these kinds of atrocities all over the country. And I think at some point they're going to be, have to be held to account, need to look at things like a commission of inquiry that lays the groundwork for war crimes trials in the future. And so we can tell them, if you persist, if you continue to do what you're doing, you're going to face the dock like Milosevic or any other war criminal.
John, thank you.
Thank you.
John Prendergast is an advisor to the International Crisis Group.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The latest rumor making the rounds in Washington goes something like this. Vice President Dick Cheney, who dismissed his doctor because of a drug addiction, will find a new one who tells him he's medically unfit to run again. Cheney goes, President Bush chooses a new running mate, and it's on to victory in November. Well, Cheney, of course, is denying all of this, saying he has no plans to step down. And joining us to talk about the politics, the juicy rumors, and assorted other aspects of campaign 2004 are John Harwood, political editor of the Wall Street Journal. Hello, John.
Great to be here.
And Richard Wolff, Washington political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hello, Richard.
Hi, good to be with you.
Let's start with this Cheney rumor. He says he's not going anywhere, but the rumors are persisting nonetheless. What's behind them? Who's behind them? And is there any indication they're credible?
Gail, I think it's a symptom of the political difficulty that the Bush ticket is having right now, not just President Bush, who's got big problems with the war in Iraq and anxieties about the economy, but Dick Cheney specifically has in some ways become a symbol of the rightward drift of the administration. He's tied to contracting problems in Iraq through his former company, Halliburton, and to some of the issues about secrecy and the use of executive authority surrounding his energy task force, and also the way intelligence was used in the run-up to Iraq. All this has made him a lightning rod. His poll numbers are down, and that leads to speculation about him leaving the ticket, even though if you talk to people at the White House or the Bush campaign, they will say it is simply not going to happen.
Well, and even the polls. I just saw one that says a majority of Americans want him to stay on the ticket, that 7 in 10 Republicans want Cheney to stay.
Gail, you know, I know that the guy is has a great deal of loyalty and position with the president. What's interesting to me is not so much the rumor, because rumors pop up and down in Washington all the time. What's interesting is that he's still deployed very publicly by the Bush campaign. They understand what the polls are like, but they don't see him as a negative. In fact, they see him as a positive force, especially with a conservative base. And it's interesting to see them riding over the rumors and still being concerned about nurturing and stroking that conservative base. And for that purpose, Dick Cheney still serves a very good purpose for them.
Well, Richard, I also want to ask you about John Edwards, who's someone you've been covering and writing about, and in fact, whom you recently described as not just good, he's the Stepford Veep. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that he's almost a parody of a perfect candidate. And there's something faintly spooky about that. It's not normal, as they say in the movie. He has this tremendous rapport with an audience, but his message itself is, I hate to use the word, but it's kind of trite. It's very patriotic, very optimistic. It's almost as if he's made a virtue out of being positive. His message is to be positive. The crowds love it for sure. I'm not sure how it translates in terms of votes. Obviously, the tickets numbers haven't got up hugely. I think the great benefit of John Edwards is almost as a tutor in politicking and campaigning for John Kerry. He looks great. He sounds great. But there's not a whole lot of there.
Well, John, your paper just reported on a Zogby poll of some of the swing states. What are you finding?
Well, first of all, I don't find anything spooky about John Edwards. I think John Edwards is very good. And to judge from watching John Kerry yesterday, as I did in West Virginia, he could use some more tutelage from John Kerry because he's still not a stellar stump speaker, even though he's had a good bit of practice over the last few years. I also think that there might be more there than Richard thinks. John Edwards is a very smart guy. He has not been in politics a long time, so he's not as grounded in the issues as Bill Clinton was when Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992. But I think John Edwards has Bill Clinton-level talent in terms of connecting with an audience. Now, the question is, how much good is that going to do for John Kerry in the states where it counts? John Edwards is a Southerner. He'll probably have his greatest individual impact in the state of North Carolina in terms of lifting Kerry's numbers, but that doesn't mean Kerry's going to carry North Carolina. In fact, the odds are that he won't. So one of the questions for the Kerry Edwards ticket is, where exactly can he make a difference among blue-collar voters in battleground states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Missouri? He might make some difference. It's possible that he could make border southern states like Virginia, like Arkansas and Louisiana more competitive, but that's not clear. What is clear, though, is that he is the best talent in the Democratic Party in terms of going out and working an audience. And one more point about the positivity. He was positive in the Democratic primaries. He didn't attack his opponents, and that was a virtue for John Edwards. He's going to attack George Bush and Dick Cheney very aggressively this fall, so he's going to leaven that image a bit.
And what about some of the peripheral players, the folks who have been moving from the sidelines to the spotlight? I'm thinking here of Elizabeth Edwards and Teresa Hines Carey. Also, the presidential children have been out. Does any of this have much effect?
I think it has a great effect. You know, this is the season to humanize the candidates, and the families do a very effective job of that. The daughters, you know, the problem for the Bush campaign is that coming so soon after those adorably cute pictures of the Edwards family, it does look a bit like a Me Too tactic. But I think this has been in the pipeline for a long time. Seeing the president's daughters out there, you know, they're obviously still a little uncertain about their role. Yes, there are high-profile pictures, but they're uncomfortable with delivering a speech that's been written for them. So that's kind of awkward for them. Elizabeth Edwards, on the other hand, I am totally taken with. I think people connect with her as a regular woman who doesn't sound like a politician and seems just very immediate and personable. And I also think she is actually very smart, too. So all of these factors are useful for the candidates at this stage. But this is a sort of biographical period. And of course, after the summer ends, we're going to move into a period where we're going to forget about their families and focus on the sort of horse trading of insults and policy, hopefully.
And, John, what do you make of that? When we see things like the First Lady or the would-be First Ladies doing bake-offs, I mean, does that make people gag a little bit, or do people find that charming?
Well, I think Richard's exactly right. This is the time to humanize these candidates, and it is a help. Elizabeth Edwards is a talented campaigner in her own right, is very bright. And I think Laura Bush with the Republican Party faithful is a tremendous asset for this president. And I think Teresa Hines, who some Democrats had worried would be sort of a loose cannon who might say things that embarrass John Kerry, is going to be an asset for him. But once we get past the introductory stage of this convention, there are really four events that matter in a big way in terms of connecting with the American public for the rest of this campaign. One of them is John Kerry's convention speech, and the other are the three debates this fall. And when the public locks in on those moments, those really are going to be where the election's decided.
Richard, in the last 10 or so seconds we have, last word?
Yeah, absolutely. Debates. The convention is important as a set piece, but everyone's going to look for that energy between the rival candidates. I'd like to see John Edwards debate George Bush. I know it's not going to happen, and Cheney versus Kerry, but that's a debate for the future.
Interesting concept, at any rate. Gentlemen, thank you both.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
John Harwood is political editor of The Wall Street Journal. Richard Wolff is Washington political correspondent for Newsweek magazine.
Still to come, author John Irving and director Todd Williams, who's turned a popular Irving novel into a critically acclaimed film.
You're listening to Here and Now.
What's your name?
Smith.
Oh, Smithy,
if you like.
What's your purpose in Port Royal, Mr. Smith? And no lies.
Right then. I confess. It is my intention to commandeer one of these ships, pick up a crew in Tortuga, raid, pillage, plunder, and otherwise pilfer my Weasley black guts out.
That's Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow in the hit movie Pirates of the Caribbean, a scene that sounds pretty tame, and the film was enormously popular with kids and rated PG-13 by the Motion Picture Association of America. But some parents might have been surprised at how scary and violent it was. There were those skeletons and stabbings. What they were seeing on the big screen was ratings creep. At least according to Kimberly Thompson, co-author of a study of movie ratings. She's an associate professor of risk analysis at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's on the line. And Kimberly, ratings creep, what's that?
What ratings creep basically means is that we are seeing more violent sexual content and profanity in movies now of a given rating like PG-13 or R than we saw 10 years ago. Many parents have suspected this, but we've actually shown it in this study.
Well, actually, give us a comparison, because you've made many, to a film 10 years ago and a film now.
You can compare the 1994 movie The Santa Claus, which was rated PG, to the sequel, which came out in 2002, rated G.
So did the G-rated movie have as much violence as the PG 10 years ago?
Yeah, in my opinion, it did.
Yeah, how did you find that? Did you have some sort of a method of determining how much violence was in the movie?
There are two independent organizations that provide extensive content information for parents, and those are KidsInMind.com and ScreenIt.com. They provide a numerical rating, but also a lot of information about the actual content. And, of course, with movies, you can always just watch them.
Which you did. You compared, for instance, Forrest Gump,
yep,
which was PG-13 in 1994, and then 2002, Minority Report, which was that Tom Cruise movie in a terrifying futuristic world, which was also rated PG-13, same as Forrest Gump 10 years ago.
Right. In fact, I was trying to give a comparison of movies that were PG-13, but really bumping up against the R, you know, and in 1994, that was Forrest Gump, and in 2002, that's Minority Report. And you can really, you know, just watch those two movies and compare them.
Another finding of yours was pretty interesting. You said that there's more violence in G-rated animated films compared with non-animated films.
That's right. I think a lot of times parents just assume because something is animated, it's appropriate for kids. But it turns out that there is significantly more violence in those animated movies. Like, you can think about the shark scene in Finding Nemo, mm-hmm, or when Simba watches his uncle kill his father in The Lion King.
Ugh.
Those are very scary scenes. And in the G-rated movies, the most popular one that comes to mind for me recently is The Princess Diaries, where, you know, sort of the most violent scene from that is when Mia hits Josh with her shoe. That's the kind of comparison to have in mind. And, you know, parents really do need to know that animation doesn't necessarily mean appropriate for kids.
Well, so what are you suggesting?
Well, we suggest everybody has to be responsible here. What that means is that kids need to be media literate. Parents need to pay attention to what their kids are watching and talk to their kids. And the industry absolutely has to provide better information to all of us.
And do I understand that the study also suggests that instead of an age-based rating system, there's a violence-based rating system?
Well, really, I think we need to think about a content-based system. And the most important thing to me is that we think about standards, because right now it's clear that there really aren't a consistent standard. So parents don't necessarily know what to expect, and I think that would be a big improvement.
Well, Kimberly, thank you.
Thank you.
Kimberly Thompson, Associate Professor of Risk Analysis at Harvard School of Public Health and co-author of the study on ratings creep in films for kids. Stay with us. There's more ahead.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Director Todd Williams has to be a happy man. His new film, The Door in the Floor, based on the John Irving novel A Widow for 1 Year, opened on Wednesday to rapturous reviews. A.O. Scott of The New York Times says it's the best movie ever made from Irving's fiction, and maybe even better than the book. High praise for a second-time director and for such a daunting task. The Door in the Floor tells the story of Ted and Marion Cole. He, a famous children's author who sucks the air out of every room he enters. She, a beautiful blonde who barely breathes. Both trying to cope with the death of their two teenage sons in a car accident 3 years earlier, while raising their 4-year-old daughter Ruth in the rarefied air of the Hamptons.
I want to put in a swimming pool.
Why?
Oh, for Ruth when she gets older. Something like the one we had in Providence. They loved it. And the lawn. That'd be more like an athletic field.
No.
Jeff Bridges as Ted Cole, Kim Basinger as his wife, Marion. Soon, Eddie O'Hare will come into the Coles' life. Played by newcomer John Foster, Eddie is a prep school kid spending the summer as Ted's assistant. Before long, he is also the grieving Marion's lover. Director Todd Williams also wrote the screenplay for A Door in the Floor, and Todd and author John Irving visited our studios before this week's rave reviews. I began our conversation by asking Irving to respond to the notion that his book is over 700 pages long, and about 500 of them are missing from the movie.
That was Todd's idea, and it's a very good one. There's a precedent for it. Volker Schlerndorff did the same thing with Günter Grass's novel, The Tin Drum. But I feel very well treated as a novelist because he's been so faithful to act one of a novel in three acts that almost nothing got left out.
Todd, a little intimidating. You've directed one other film, The Adventures of Sebastian Cole, and here you are taking down a John Irving novel.
It was such an outlandish proposition that you just had to. What happened was, is I read the novel and had no intention of looking for something to adapt in it, and I probably wouldn't have thought that this would be within reach anyway. But when I read it and I read that section, it stood out to me as something that would be an interesting movie. I worked on a letter to John explaining my intentions for about 3 weeks and revised that and hammered that out. And that, in a way, became a treatment in my mind.
Does it feel cinematic to you? Because it does when I read John Irving.
Well, I think often the characters are people that you start seeing in such three dimension that my mind goes to cinema. And I also think in particular this story, in many specific places, John really tells it with images, even things like objects like a sweater on a bed that advance the story in a way that is perfect for movies.
I'm thinking also of objects like the pictures on the wall, the black and white photos of the two dead boys that line a hall in the house and disappear at the end of the movie. They become a character. John, could you tell us first why you created them and then, Todd, how you incorporated them in the film?
Well, I think so much of this novel and so much of the film that Todd has made from it is about how we respond to what's missing, how we respond to what we lose, whether it's unspeakably your own children, whether your mother leaves you. And in the case of Ruth, who's 4, not only does her mother leave her, but she takes away the visual evidence of those dead brothers that she never met, but whom she recognizes are more permanently a part of her parents' life than she feels she is. So it's a dark story, but the picture hooks in that sort of naked hall is symbolic to me of a whole family history being taken away by the extreme dysfunction in this family, which has been caused by the death of those boys.
The pictures were central, and that's why I wanted to get them up there as quick as possible. In fact, they come on the third cut in the film, and we linger on them, and they come back many times and occasionally are even accompanied by subtle sound effects in order to make them feel like they have some resonant life.
I would say that the two films made from my novels that are inarguably the best are the Cider House rules, which I adapted myself, and the door in the floor, because Todd has been not only so faithful to the novel, but he's created scenes that were never in the novel, but which are so much in tone and in keeping with the characters and the story. Mm. All I did was keep sending him notes.
What's that like for you, John? I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall when you get this letter and you think, darn, that's a good idea for a scene. Why didn't I think of that when I wrote it?
I was doubly relieved. I was relieved that it was a good idea, and I was relieved that someone else had the enthusiasm to write it, because I still didn't want to write it. He had the vision. Yeah. It was his vision.
But what about that vision? I mean, you've got one in your head for, 5 years. Has the image of Marion, the mother, changed in your head from a brunette to a blonde? Is that one that was in your head? Is she gone?
No, I never thought that the color of her hair was as important as her impact as a beautiful older woman is on Eddie.
Some readers have been critical of the relationship between the young boy, Eddie, and the mother, asking, you know, what are you saying, John Irving? Is it okay for an older woman to bring a young man into an affair because she's in grief?
I don't say it's okay. I say it happens. My responsibility is to make something happen credibly, to make people complicated, and to try to ask you to withhold your judgment, to ask people to retain sympathy for people who are doing unsympathetic things by understanding the context in which they might do them. I think that's the storyteller's job. It's too easy to make you like somebody who's as nice as a marshmallow. I'll also just say this about the frankness of the sexuality in my work in general and in this film in particular. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. The relationship between Ted and Marion isn't about sex. It's about grief. Marion is not happy. And that's one of the great fidelities that Todd, as a writer and a director, has to my novel. Americans are so immature about sexuality, it's embarrassing. And if you feel that way about sex, if you feel that things that shouldn't happen, so to speak, in real life should not be depicted on screen or described in books, then I would recommend to such people that they restrict their reading to newspapers and magazines.
Is that your dinner?
Sort of, yeah. I'm kind of tired of burgers. I've had one every night since I got here.
Ted doesn't get you anything?
Not really. I mean, he would. It's just I don't think Ruth likes to eat with me.
I don't think your parents would like it if they thought we weren't taking care of you.
They wouldn't mind, really, I don't think.
Eddie, would you like to go to dinner one night? I'll make sure you get something decent.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Good.
What about the loss of children? It's something you seem you're able to look at. I read that you were first influenced by Pip in Great Expectations. What is it about that seems to draw you, loss of children or loss for a child?
Well, it's the worst thing I can think of, and I have a sort of a disaster-prone imagination. I suppose it seems to me that my job in imagining a story is to imagine the consequences of every little thing, especially the worst consequences that can ensue from every little thing. And I can't imagine a story worth telling where something awful doesn't happen. How we deal with what we lose is what many of my books are about, sometimes comically, certainly in the case of losing children, less so. But as a parent myself, as someone who was a father before I even graduated from college, I was a very young father, my world changed upon the birth of my first child. The world changed. It became a scary place. I became a fearful and frightened person. I realized that there was someone else in my life that I had no choice about loving, and my fear for them became huge. And my imagination changed as a result of that. I became a different writer because I had children, because I have children. And I'm not sorry about that. There's nothing I can do to change it.
Author John Irving and director Todd Williams. The Door in the Floor is now in theaters across the country.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.